This is entrepreneur and author John McLaughlin thanking you for listening to another amazing episode of The Road to Rediscovery. It's time to sit back, relax, and listen as your host, Aubrey Johnson, safely navigates us through life's challenges and guides us on a rewarding path of self-discovery.
Our lives are laid out on a road of bumps, turns, struggles, and more. How do we respond? How do we endure adversity for learning and growth? I'm Aubrey Johnson, and we'll explore these questions and more on The Road to Rediscovery.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Road to Rediscovery. I'm your host, Aubrey Johnson. The Road to Rediscovery is about reflecting on life lessons to learn and grow from them, and of course, pay it forward and uplift others who are struggling through dark times. Now, I'm here to tell you, the Road to Rediscovery Stand Store is officially open. That's right, officially open. Inspired by the many amazing guests and interesting topics you've heard on this show, this store has all kinds of great resources focused on your personal growth, from free e-guides to wellness ebooks to the full-blown Rediscovery Roadmap digital course. Trust me, we got you covered for getting back on track with an action plan to conquer your adversities and to realize your true potential for success. Stop by and visit our store at stand.store/road to rediscovery. That's stand.store/road2rediscovery. And as always, we are truly, truly grateful for your listenership. All right. My special guest is the father of three boys and the author of Four Lessons from My Three Sons, How You Can Raise Resilient Kids. Here he outlines his parenting techniques and the path of his sons through childhood, adolescence, all the way to and beyond the U.S. Naval Academy, Williams College, and West Point. He's been featured on USA Today, Parents Magazine, among others, and an Army veteran himself. He formerly worked for three members of U.S. Congress and served twice as a presidential appointee. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great honor to welcome Mr. Jeff Nelligan to the show. Jeff, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you here.
Wow. Well, Aubrey, it's great to be here. What a send up. My gosh, I'm blushing and I'm kind of tingling. There you go.
Oh, well, thank you. And you know what? We reciprocate. We're equally tingling. We are equally excited. We can't wait to get this thing started right off the road. So excited to have you here. So here's how I'd like for us to just kind of jump into this and unpack this, Jeff, if you don't mind here.
Certainly.
We are going to have some incredible insights, or you're going to share some incredible insights in the world of American parenting. But I want to just ask you, how accurate is this, if accurate at all? I personally am a believer that our parenting styles can often be a combination of things that we've learned to do from watching our parents and things that we've learned not to do by watching our parents. Start us off on what you experienced as a child growing up.
Certainly. You know, I like that beginning because the parent of today was the kid of parents yesterday.
Yes.
And watching the parents and how they dealt with all sorts of situations, good and bad, you know, great jobs, lost jobs.
Yes.
The neighborhoods you lived in, the way they treated each other, your mom and dad, the way they treated the adults in the community and equally important, the kids in the community.
Yes.
I had great fortune. I was blessed. I had superb parents and they were old school. They were from, you know, the greatest generation, and they passed down what today we call values, but for them was just the way of life. And right. It inculcated all the values that I put into the book.
Man, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Yeah. And you know, you have to have a foundation from somewhere, right? And this is clearly your foundation. So I want to thank you for sharing that and giving us a glimpse into, you know, what that was like for you growing up. And if it appears that I'm kind of darting back and forth, I apologize, but you, I hope, can appreciate where we're going to go with this. I want to ask you a point blank question now, Jeff.
Sure.
Are children more resilient and tougher than we give them credit for?
I wish they were, but yeah, there's too many statistics out there that will tell us that we've got a generation of children that is less resilient, perhaps less mm-hmm. resilient, definitely, than, let's say, if you're looking at the iGen generation born around 1909,
yeah,
Gen Z around 1997, you know, the millennials 1981. I think over the course of those generations, you see numbers of just behavioral and otherwise physical yeah. that would demonstrate that no, they're not as resilient. When you've got, you know, 44% of kids are identified by their own parents as having a mental health malady. Mm. Children between the ages of 10 and 18 are spending approximately 8 hours and 47 minutes a day on a phone or yeah. screen. When kids 3 to 5 are spending over 90 minutes a day on a screen. When wow. 21% of children in this country are overweight or obese, one yeah. out of five.
Yeah.
So you look at those markers, you know, and those psychological, physical, emotional. No, I don't think they're as resilient as past generations.
Gotcha. No, that makes a lot of sense. And that is some true to life examples in, yeah. in backing that up for sure. You know, you just mentioned something regarding technology, devices, yeah. and things like that. And there was something on your blog that I found quite fascinating. And it's something that, you know, I truly believe that it's a must do for any of today's parents. You talk about ending the digital addiction nightmare and yeah. and entering into agreements with, you know, with your children. And I wanted mm-hmm. to know if you could please share some insight in that, particularly the importance of accountability and demonstrating that in yeah. what you mentioned in the blog.
Certainly, you know, the guru behind my thoughts on the digital addiction nightmare is a man named Dr. Jonathan Haidt.
Yeah.
1 year ago yesterday, believe it or not, he published a book called The Anxious Generation, which is full of stats, data, long-term yeah. studies of kids, and showing that the increasing use of digital media is making kids, no surprise, more anxious. So I started with, you know, following Haidt 15 years ago, when he was beginning to make a name for himself in terms of this phenomenon, along with a woman named Dr. Jean Twenge out of San Diego State University.
Yeah.
And the conclusions they reached back then are the same ones they've reached now, only we've had 15 years of a laboratory test and the saturation, the addiction has only gotten worse. So the idea, and this was kind of Haidt's, but others picked up on it, was to have what you were looking at there, Aubrey, was the social media contract. And yes. I like the word you used, accountability. And the social media contract is simple. You sit down with your kids one day and you say, you know what? This has all got to end because you're a zombie. Now, this is very, very harsh talk. It's very direct.
Yeah, yeah.
But the kid that you don't sit down with and say at age 12, you know, your screen time is going to be greatly diminished and you're playing Call of Duty and the laptop and the iPad, that same kid at 24, 12 years later, is going to be living in your basement playing Minecraft.
100%.
Okay? Now, that sounds really harsh. And guess yeah. what? It is. Because those examples are all around us. 48% yeah. of males between the ages of 18 and 32 live with their parents.
My goodness.
Again, you can talk about anecdotes, but those, you know, the numbers bring it home. Haidt's book, Anxious Generation, is crammed with these kind of data points and statistics. Again, yeah. long-term studies, extensive studies done as from his professorship at New York University.
Gotcha. Man, I mean, and that those are staggering numbers, and they just continue to grow. It seems like, you know, and it's basically with our generation being the parent generation, the parental generation. Quite frankly, it's a disservice to the children, right, in preparing them for the world out there by letting them do this. Right.
That's correct. Preparing is another good word, because by starting with the social media contract, you prepare them for that new world. That is, you're getting an hour on a screen a day.
Yes.
And on the weekends, I'm, you know, Friday night at 10, it's going away.
Yeah.
And at 8 o'clock at night, we're shutting down the routers in the house, and you're not bringing it out in the car.
Yeah.
You're not bringing it out at the dinner table.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, and this is why I use the word accountability too, because Aubrey, we spoke about this earlier, the parent, as we both kind of agreed, has to set the example. So the parent is the one that cannot be on the phone, on the screen at an enormous rate. The actual number for people 18 to 50 is around 11 and a half hours a day on a screen, either phone, laptop, iPad.
That's a lot of time.
Right, that is. And you wonder, you're on that screen that long. Yes, certainly some of it's for work.
Yeah,
that time some of that time could be spent with your kid.
Sure could.
And the 9 hours the kid's spending on his phone could be spent, if you cut it to one, could be spent with you. Again, this is, you know, I'm giving you the kind of a badass, harsh elucidation of all this, but it's only shock treatment that's going to work. I mentioned the 12-year-old, and I say that because by the age of 12, 75% of the time we're going to spend with our kid is over.
That's right.
And by the time he's 18 or she is 18, it's 90%. So if you don't drill these kind of qualities and characteristics into a kid early, the culture raises them. And I'm not certain there's any reasonable person on the planet that thinks the culture is going to be good for raising a kid.
No, not at all. I mean, it starts in the home and it starts early. And that's how I was raised to believe. And that's how I raised, you know, my son. And so, you know, coming at it harsh, and if it is shock treatment that's needed, especially given the dynamic of today's society with so much technology, inundation of screen time in so many different ways. Now AI is coming into play and everything, you know, and I think we mentioned this in a past conversation we had, you know, both my parents served. And so being a military brat, my siblings and I, we moved around a lot. And so, you know, mom and dad came down on us, you know, with a lot of rules, chores, when to be in bed, when to get up, you know, and just everything as far as, you know, keeping your room clean, the bed is made, clothes are folded, you know, just goes on and on. Right. And so I get into my early teens and, you know, I just hear this stuff and, you know, parents were loving, very loving as well, but every other thing it felt like coming out of their mouths was a rule, you know, or did you do this or did you do that, you know? And then one time I just, you know, dad and I, we his thing, he loved going to play the ponies, loved going to the racetrack. So, you know, that was the way I connected with them. I mean, I wish I could have said, you know, him and I tossed the ball in the backyard, but it wasn't like that with him and I. He had different interests and things. And so, you know, to connect with him, I'd go with him to the racetrack. I was 14, 15. And I just looked at him one time and I said, Dad, man, I appreciate everything you provide, but I just want to know, man, so many rules and our younger brother, he's of a different time where he's used to things being told to him in a kind way. And that's not how it was with my sister and I being the older two. And so, you know, I didn't ask him why, but I'm just like, you know, it's a lot. And then he looked at me and he calmly said, and he only did this one time and he didn't have to say it anymore. He looked at me calmly, put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, son, I wouldn't say a word if I didn't care.
Yeah.
And that's all that he's had to say. That's all he had to say. You know, I wouldn't say a word if I didn't care. And so from there, to me, that just said it all. And it taught me to read between the lines, get the true message underneath how it's delivered, you know, and have a more cerebral type of response to it. And a little less emotional, especially if you feel like someone's coming down on you, like your parent, you know, he wouldn't say anything if he didn't care. So, to me, that, you know, it kind of taught me some lessons, from him just saying, you know, that phrase right there, which brings me to my next question, Jeff, regarding real world and real world lessons. Okay. I want to ask this, if you can, share specifically in your experience in raising your boys, what was the first real world lesson that you had to give your boys early in their childhood? And, if you can share, maybe what was that lesson?
Certainly. And I must say, that's a very touching story about your father. And I personally, I adore it, because that's an engaged parent is going to say that kind of thing. An engaged parent is going to say there are rules for a reason. The disengaged parent, you know, you're never going to get a straight, you know, a straight boundary ever.
Right. And
if you don't have a straight boundary when you're, let's say, 14 or 15, like you were at the track, when you're 25 or 26, you still don't have a boundary.
You still don't have a boundary.
You're floundering around. In terms of examples, you know, the one that I think really kind of set the tone, and it was followed by many others, but one stands out in particular in my mind is, I was with the boys at a big mall, indoor mall here in the DC area, and just Saturday, surging crowds, noise, you know, typical pandemonium. And I took my wallet out of my pocket and I said, and I opened it and I said, gave each kid a $5 bill. And I said, guys, go get change. I don't care how long it takes. It's not a race, but don't come back here. And I'll be standing right here trying to keep an eye on you, but go get change and come back. Now, the eldest was about 7. The youngest was 4.
Okay.
And off they went. They were excited about a task that was going to be something out of the, you know, the normal realm of life. And so they, you know, it took some time. One kid struck out a couple stores. Another kid came back with 20 quarters in his pocket. They all came back and they were enthused. They'd taken this challenge out of nowhere and navigated on their own in the midst of strangers in a strange place, this task. So I would replicate that all the time. And then I would do different shifts. You know, we'd show up to a 7-Eleven and I'd point to the 5-year-old and say, here's a $20 bill, go and get, you know, Gatorade and Doritos.
Yeah.
Or we'd be at a restaurant and I'd point to the 6-year-old and I'd say, you memorize our entire order and tell the waiter what we're going to
have. Right.
And so those tests on and on and on. And, you know, we're at an airport and they're a little bit older. And I just give one kid the paperwork and I say, hey, go get us 5 boarding passes.
Nice.
I don't know how you do it. You have to go up to a, you know, at that point, there was not too many kiosks. So you actually had to go up to a human being.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they learned that, that life was presented them with these challenges that they had to do on their own amidst strangers. And they had to get over this, you know, mild adversity. And of course, you know, I explained, you know, a guy who can do that at 4 years old, walk into a, you know, store after store to get change. That same guy is 24 years old and he's officer of the deck on a guided missile destroyer in the Persian Gulf at midnight. And Iranian patrol boats are coming at him and he's in a minefield. Mm. And the kid can make a decision. He can react to that adversity because his whole life has just been this reflexive reaction to different situations and challenges.
Right.
And so at 24, he can make that and make the right decision and, you know, be responsible at the same time for 250 guys on the ship. So that's how it plays out in the real world, because, you know, Aubrey, we talked about this too. Our job as parents, in my humble opinion, is not just to build a relationship with our child. We already have that.
Right.
Our job is to teach that kid to build a relationship with the world that's right outside the front door. And that could be the neighborhood, or it could be the Boy Scouts, or it could be athletic fields, the school, the barber shop, the mall, the robotics club. But the idea that the kid can move with grace and with ease through all sorts of different circumstances and not panic.
100%. It's a big world out there. And you know what? I mean, and I don't want to sound selfish or anything, but we as parents want to be assured that our son, our daughter, who goes out that door into the world, that they're prepared and they're ready for it. But we have to own the part in preparing them. And that lesson, those lessons that you kind of repeatedly and incrementally have kind of instilled in your boys' heads with just random tasks, that's huge, because it gives them the problem-solving skills, specifically when they're by themselves with around a bunch of people, a space they're not familiar with, people they're not familiar with, and make decisions and problem solve through a situation, you know, to figure things out. And I mean, I call it the sink or swim syndrome, right? I mean, as harsh as it may sound, I mean, back in the day, right? Our uncle would pick us up, and whether we knew how to swim or not, we're 2-3 years old. And he goes over in the 6 feet and he tosses you in the water. Well, what are you going to do? You know, flap your arms, or are you just going to sink like a stone? Well, guess I'm going to have to figure it out. But it's kind of like that. And to me, that just sharpens the sword even more and more and more as they get older, to where they are sharp enough to make these decisions when they're out on the Persian Gulf, like you mentioned.
Yeah, you know, I like that problem solving. That's really what it is, you know. Mm-hmm. And once you start problem solving at age 4 or age 5 or 6, you continue to do it, it's like the old, you know, athletic adage, muscle memory. Yes. It becomes a reflex that you know what to do, that even if you're in a tight situation, you don't panic. You start to think, how do I get out of this? Or how do I get around it?
Exactly.
You know, there's not this curl up in a little ball, or, you know, the whining about it, or just reflexive defensive measure. No, you know how to charge through it. Again, this is, you know, I'm bringing it in hot here, but I always think the parents need to hear it, because, as I said, by the age of 12, 75% of their time they've been around that kid is over.
It sure is.
25% is left from 12 to whenever that parent passes on.
Yeah. And that's time you're not going to get back.
Never.
No, we have to maximize that. And not just for our benefit and being in the present moment to enjoy, but for their benefit in sharpening their problem solving skills, improving their discipline, and letting them know that there is a whole world out there that is more tangible, more meaningful than any software that or device that you have in your hands.
Yes.
Okay. And that's truly something that you must embrace first, right?
Right. Because if you don't, and I like that, that software in your hand is you know, pretty meaningless in the real world. Because now we have the Gen Z is now entering the real world.
Yeah.
And some big surveys done by Forbes and Wallet Hub have shown, and big surveys, 2,500 plus, have shown, looking at managers who hire Gen Z, they note that 65% of Gen Z new hires are fired within the first year.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because they're continually late to meetings. They don't wear the right things to work.
No.
Their work product is substandard, and that, you know, many employers now, something around 28%, don't even look at Gen Z. They'll go with older workers because they can't afford the time and the effort. But the best stat from the two surveys was this. We were talking, you know, you were talking about, you know, being there in the moment and the kids standing up.
Right.
33% of Gen Z kids bring their parent to their first employment interview.
Is that right? I had no idea.
1 out of 3 Gen Z applicants to a job will bring their parent to an interview. Now, if that doesn't show how you wonderfully begun this, resilience, gosh, nothing does.
Nothing does. let's break down that a little bit. Okay. I want to make sure first off that I'm tracking you, in saying this, data point, because I've never heard of it before. And it gives me an initial impression. Gen Z bringing their parent to their first interview.
Yeah. One out of three. Correct.
Okay. I'll be honest with you, Jeff. I'm not quite sure how to think of that.
I don't know. It's unbelievable to even consider. And of course, if you're a hiring manager and you know, you're either in your office or on a Zoom call and yeah. mom or dad is sitting next to Junior, you're thinking, how quick can I end this?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
How fast can I get both those fannies out the door?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. As an employer, I would be thinking that. And
oh my gosh.
You know, yeah. and another thing I would be thinking, I guess, you know, kind of facetiously is, hey, it's not like the young adult is 17, 18, and they're a star athlete, and I'm a coach from a D1 college trying right. to you know, recruit him or her, and need to talk to the parents as well because it's his education. They haven't graduated from high school. This is beyond high school.
Yeah,
graduation.
This is after they're an adult. College. This is 23 or 24. Yeah.
My gosh. Yes. That is, I mean, if that doesn't spell ill preparedness in my mind, I don't know what does.
Well, it goes back to the resilience factor. Yeah. The guy, the kid, male or female, is not comfortable around other human beings because yeah. I guess that's the outgrowth of spending 8 hours and 47 minutes a day on a screen.
Yeah.
The idea of social interaction is a challenge rather than a natural every moment, every day type of endeavor.
That's what it sounds like. And it's basically kind of reversing that screen time, right? It's more the rule than the exception. And and that's an unfortunate data point.
And again, you know, and the screen time and what it does to anxiety, particularly young girls.
Yeah.
As I said, it's all documented in Jonathan Haidt's Anxious Generation, which was for weeks and weeks number one on the New York Times bestseller list because so many parents were buying it and kind of waking up to the kind of monsters that had been created in their kids.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and again, to your point, at age 12, right?
Yes.
You're going to start to get considerably less time with your child. Oh, yeah. And it makes it harder to undo something that you've done or that was done, right. You know, at that point. Right.
And that's the shock treatment factor. That's yeah. the social media contract coming into play, because if you know, changing a kid at 12, it's almost like putting them on lockdown.
Yeah, it is. They're like, I can't believe you're doing this to me.
Right. And guess what? You know,
yeah,
I'm doing it now. So you're not in the basement 12 years from now playing Call of Duty. It's real simple.
Yeah. You'll thank me later.
Yeah.
Oh gosh. You mentioned something about society and social media, obviously, and particularly the statistic with girls. I wanted to ask you regarding societal influence on raising resilient kids. Can you use the same methods in raising girls as you do boys to teach mental toughness, mental strength, as I put it often, and resilience? But is there, I don't know, is there some sort of societal influence that kind of is making it more of a challenge to be consistent in teaching that resilience between boys and girls?
Yeah, and Haight, Jonathan Haight goes into that in his book that the real the link between particularly Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok on young women and in terms of their bodies and just the influencer crowd. But, you know, you can the same qualities that I taught my kids, you know, the four that are in the book, you know, personal conduct, confidence, resilience in adversity, and ambition.
Yes.
You can teach girls too. I mean, all you have to do is look at the NCAA, you know, Sweet 16 going on right now women's basketball.
Yeah.
I mean, the colleges across this country are full of, you know, young women who are leaders. Even the ones that sit on the bench are the leaders. So the idea that they don't exist, of course they do. They're all out there. I mean, you had a woman run for president, you know, five, 6 months ago. You know, Christine Lagarde is head of the European Union. I mean, there's plenty of role models for women out there that are not Madonna or Lady Gaga.
No.
It's just giving them the prominence they deserve.
100%.
So I don't think there's any difference at all. I think girls have it tougher. I think the society is misogynistic.
Yeah.
And I think I don't know why that attraction. Maybe it's a centuries old thing that, you know, boys maybe are less influenced by the culture around them, or they're equally influenced, but the culture is so misogynistic that women and young girls have to conform a little bit. And that's a shame.
Yeah, that is a shame. I mean, but it seems like in spite of that, we are starting to see a surge of more female leaders.
Oh yeah.
In different areas, from military to athletics, whether it's professional athletics or collegiate athletics, public service, right?
Right.
And to me, that's quite impressive. I hope it continues in that trend. And I hope, you know, as it continues in that trend, the misogyny hopefully can kind of mitigate a little bit.
You hope that happens. I mean, you know, look, the White House press secretary is a female.
Yeah, that's true.
She's not even, she's 28 years old and she's a ball breaker.
Yeah, she already is. Pulls no punches.
Tell that she's one of the best to fill that position. And I know that because in Washington, D.C., I was a press secretary for members of Congress and cabinet officials.
Yep.
So I had the same job she does, and she's 100 times better than I ever was. And she's 28, and she is just forceful. So, you know, these women role models are all around us, and it's too bad that more women, you know, can't appreciate that or see that.
Agreed.
Yeah. More men, obviously. I mean, that's a given, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It is a given, but I would like for more women to see that as well. And Jeff, this is an extraordinary journey of a conversational journey that we're going on, because we're hitting and touching different areas, and you touched in one area I wanted to kind of bring back a little bit if we can. And, and that's it's sports. Talking about sports from the most elementary level to the most, to the most visible, I guess, at the pro level, what impact or what role of significance does something as like sports plays in adjusting the mindset of one growing up for resilience?
Well, you know, it's a topic we talked about, you know, and your wonderful son making his way, you know, up the ladder, which is Jacob's ladder to the stars in terms of basketball. But sports does three things, and it does three things really well. Being on a team means, number one, that you have to get along with a lot of people, and some of them you might not like,
right?
But you still have to get along with them. Yeah. So you instill that sense of camaraderie. The second thing about sports is if you want to get your fanny off the bench, you've got to exert the personal discipline to practice whatever the sport is.
Right.
And that means a lot of lonely nights and days doing that sport, whether it be lifting weights or running or throwing a lacrosse ball against a wall.
Yes, yes.
Or pushing tires across a football field.
That's right.
And the third thing that's great about sports is because it's life. It, you know, in sports, there's a scoreboard at the end and there's a winner and a loser.
That's right.
And, you know, there's no platitudes. There's no equivocation. You won or you lost. And if you get too complacent losing, then, you know, that's not setting is going to set a great example for how you're going to accept the real world challenges in life.
Right.
Like getting into college and doing well in college and getting a job. Yes. Doing well at that and having friends and hopefully a wife or a husband down the line. So those are the three elements. Now that the sports metaphor is easy. And I always say this because, and I say this because my sons were pretty darn good at sports. I'll come back to that in a moment. Mm-hmm. Sports metaphor is in the theater. It's in the marching band. It's in the robotics club. It's in the Boy Scouts. It's in any kind of thing where you bring a bunch of like-minded kids together, pursuing a goal with supportive parents and, you know, extending it through a season, whatever the season is, months, several months, you know, weeks.
Yep.
So that you get that shared group together. And that's what builds the characters, you know, the characteristics in my book. Now, when you talk about from the beginning, like you framed the question, from the lowest to the highest, the most visible, I'm actually pretty fortunate because my kids started out just like any other kids, average kids, no great big size. Speed was taught to all three of them. But, you know, from fourth grade on in soccer and lacrosse, all the way through elementary and junior high and high school, they got better and better and better and started on better and better teams. And all three played in college.
Yep.
And the youngest not only played in college, he played at West Point rugby, a sport that he just walked on the field as a freshman, as a plebe, having never even touched a rugby ball or seen a rugby match.
Incredible.
And 4 years later was first team All-American, a national champion, MVP of the national championship series in Houston, and then was drafted and plays pro rugby for the DC Old Glory team.
Amazing.
And now I will say, you know, this is pro rugby. It's not pro football. It's not even pro soccer in terms of popularity in this country.
Right.
You go anywhere else in Europe or in South America and you Australia. Can easily fill, Australia, precisely. Yeah. Anywhere in the Pacific Islands.
Yeah.
You can fill a stadium with 50 or 60,000 people every weekend. Easy. It's just not the sport of the country, and that's the way it works. But what I'm saying is all those qualities are built through sports, and they're just enhanced every time. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to get to college, 8% of all the kids who play in high school will play a college sport.
Right.
And mostly that's at Division II and Division III level. And indeed, Division III number of teams is in the hundreds for almost every sport because it's cheap. But the characteristics you get out of those three things that I mentioned, the camaraderie, the personal discipline, and the win-loss is invaluable for the rest of your life.
It completely is. And as you said earlier, Jeff, I mean, sports is an easy metaphor to go into, right? And I'm glad you mentioned the others because, you know, I was going to ask you as well, you know, not all children are interested in sports to that degree, right? So what other areas of interest could you explore teaching resilience or reinforcing resilience to in that child's mind that they may have an interest in? You mentioned band, you mentioned theater, you mentioned sciences. I mean, you know, and those are other areas, you know, scouts. It's a group of people, young people coming together for a season with a common goal, right? And so that's applicable in just about every facet.
Right. And that's the thing about sports and those other endeavors.
Yeah.
There's winners and losers.
Yes.
I know that's, again, this is taking the hard road here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and a kid sees that immediately. Yep. So the kid hopefully will want to become a winner or better. You know, their team, their robotics team wants to win the county title.
Exactly.
We got to try. And the guys are in second place. Well, good for them, but they didn't try enough. Third place, same thing. Yep. But you're getting that sense of competition. This is an insanely competitive world.
Yeah.
And when you have those qualities, competition comes easier to you and it's easier to handle and manage. If you're never in a competition, then mom and dad are sitting there across the desk from a hiring manager.
Fast forward, right?
Yeah. That's where they are.
Yeah. 100% agreed. And that's what it translates to, because, you know, you don't know how to compete against other applicants, or how to have a competitive edge versus other applicants. Or your parents didn't even teach you the fundamentals or the some of the basic ways that you can set a great first impression to a potential employer, and make yourself memorable in a good way, make a positive impact to where you get that second call.
And the confidence, the confidence not to even have your parent in the same zip code when you're sitting 100%. Down with a hiring manager.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, it does sound kind of, I mean, it's only 30% show up that way.
Yeah.
But it's 65% that get fired, and it's above 50% for every indice of office life, whether it be the wrong clothes, projects late, showing up late, spending too much time on a phone.
Yeah.
It's all those elements that show a person that just doesn't have the ability to act in a social and civic manner at an age of 24, 25. And what's the end game on that, Aubrey?
Yeah, that's a great question.
The same way? Are they going to underscore some, you know, metamorphosis and change completely?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Jeff. And you know, I'm not even going to attempt to try to answer that. But one thing that comes to mind when you ask that question, I took it as a rhetorical question, but one thing that I truly was thinking and asking myself when you asked that question is it starting to evolve to where, say, Gen Z are kind of misrepresenting themselves in the evolution of the younger generation style of work? Okay.
Yeah.
Younger generation style of work, I don't know how many 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 year at one place Gen Zers are going to be down the line, because I probably won't be here. Okay. But I'm hard pressed to see the newer generations as having, instead of 25 years at one company, they may have 25 years in an industry.
Right.
And that's 20
spread, companies.
Yeah. At 20 companies or whatever. Right. So I'm seeing more of that, and more of it being an employee market, so to speak, to where they call the shots in terms of what their demands are to be an employee at this company, instead of what we grew up with the employer basically saying, this is our company, this is how we work, this is what we offer, take it or leave it. You know, so there's an evolution there. But when you have that, let's say that small percentage of those who come to those interviews with their parents, and those who show up late or not dressed appropriately, there seems to be some sort of, I don't know, I would hope it would, I mean, it would be a misrepresentation and not the true representation of a younger generation in how they show up.
Right. And, you know, I mentioned the showing up part because that statistic just absolutely, you know, befuddled the researchers at Forbes and the Wallet Hub. But the other stat is if you're losing almost 7 out of 10 after the first year, you got a major problem.
Yeah.
And it, you know, you began this by talking about generations, the whole conversation, you know, the generations of our parents raising us, you know. My dad, when he was 15, worked in a vanadium mine in the Sierra Mountains, a mile below the surface of the earth. my. And then at age 17, he went in the Navy. At 18, he was part of the Battle of Okinawa. And he spent his 19th birthday patrolling the streets of Tokyo.
My goodness. Isn't that something?
But that's most members of that generation did something like that. Oh, yeah. And by the way, he grew up during the Depression in a small town.
Yeah.
So you talk about the resiliency of different generations.
Yeah.
That's that generation. You know, we had it much easier.
Yeah.
But can you imagine, the juxtaposition of, old Don Nelligan and kids today at 18?
Yeah. Big disparity. Difference, right?
And the thing is, I can be labeled as just a crazy throwback machine guy. But those are the kind of guys and women like my mom who build a society.
Oh, completely.
And so now Gen Z is the largest generation alive. They're at about 73 million.
Oh, wow.
They're taking over. So that Gen Z in 10 years is going to be, 10 years, born in 96.
Yep.
It's going to be, 38, 39. And will they own homes? Will they be able to have children? Will they have consistent jobs?
Right.
What kind of, economic power will they have? And so it's not just, the old man screaming about his dad working in a mine. No, in 10 years from now, we'll see it. We're already seeing it. Like I said, 7 out of 10 are fired. So, I mean, again, it sounds like a doomsaying thing, but it goes back to what Haidt was writing about, Jonathan Haidt, in 2010 when these kids were 14.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is bad for them. It's going to have major impacts longitudinally on their lives. And he was right.
Oh, totally. I mean, we can see it happening. It's starting to happen. It's unfolding right before us. That is really, really interesting. I mean, as far as Gen Z now being the largest population on this earth, and I can understand why and everything, but and the disparity, right, between say a 19-year-old of the
greatest generation
who gave birth to the baby boomers, right, and then versus a 19-year-old now. I mean, back then, men lied about their age so they can get in and grab a rifle, right, and stand post and everything. And so, completely fascinating.
As an observer of this too, I can tell you the only place you can find a 19-year-old like my old man is in the Navy or the Marine Corps or the Air Force, or the Army.
Easy,
because these kids have made this decision, and there's a lot of people that think that they're that they're different kids or not smart or, violent or whatever. They made a decision to live in an institution and a structure that's demanding things just like your dad did.
Yes.
If you want to go back to your old man.
Yeah. And
the other part of that too is that today, 73% of American youths who are eligible to join the service are ineligible.
Really?
They can't pass the basic tests, academic tests, to get into services.
Right.
There are health problems, mostly obesity, medication, law enforcement, or disciplinary records. So 72% of all kids within that age group, which is 18 to about, normally cut it off around 28, 10 years, a decade, would be turned away from trying to volunteer for any of the armed services.
Aren't they still required to register at 18?
Well, yeah, they register to selective service.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
They can register, but what are you going to do with them if you actually have to call them up?
Yeah. Right. Nope, that's true. What are you going to do with them? Right.
Right. So, you don't get participation trophies in basic training.
No, you don't. Again, winners, losers, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But again, it sounds very apocalyptic, but you know, it didn't in 2010 when Haight started writing about this stuff.
Yeah.
And now he's got a best-selling books that just details in great detail the damage. So I'll leave it at that. Get off my soapbox, Aubrey.
No, that's quite all right, Jeff. And I appreciate you saying this, right? Because I mean, people take things differently. And when I hear this, I don't hear apocalyptic, you know, I don't hear the world's coming to an end, but I'm hearing, hey, here's a heads up, you know? Yeah. And when you hear it in a constructive way, then I think the next step that your mind takes you on is, okay, how can I do my part or resolve it in the areas in which I can control as a parent to my child, right? And imagine
also each, for all people, that's because that's what you're doing on this podcast.
Oh, yeah, yeah, for absolutely.
All the people that you interview have a, you know, have a way, have their prescription.
Yeah.
And maybe that it's not all of the prescription is there, but Aubrey draws out what is going to be useful to people who listen.
Oh, completely. Yeah. It has to be something that people find of value and that's relatable in terms of what their adversities are. Right. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And look, one thing that's consistent in all of our lives, we all have adversities. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So Jeff, one of the last questions I wanted to ask you, okay, is, you know, you shared some incredible insights on resilience, mental toughness, mental strength, you know, really, really hitting targeted between the eyes in, you know, what should be, what shouldn't be, what is, what and where this country is headed in terms of, you know, generationally. I want to see if we can kind of temper that with another element that I feel is important in teaching, along with that resilience, along with that mental toughness, right? Compassion for your fellow man.
Oh, yeah.
Empathy, right? Respect, right? You get what you give. Basically, you know, showing love and compassion for your fellow man, showing empathy, respect, you know, not kicking anyone while they're down, right?
Right.
I mean, everyone has tough times. Can you maybe share with us some insight in how you balance out this type of resilience raising, okay, along with just some areas of compassion and empathy that I feel are equally important.
Sure. In fact, that's so important to me. It's the first chapter of the book called personal conduct.
Yes. Oh, nice. Very nice.
You know, all my kids, I pounded into pound. Don't I sound like a great dad?
Yeah.
You know, you have a private code of personal conduct.
Yes.
And that means, you know, everything from showing up on time, showing up early to anything, to wearing the right clothing, using the right language, to listening more than speaking.
Thank you.
Which I think is the key one.
Yes.
And the last one, just the respect you hold for anybody.
Yes.
Whether it's a 2-year-old kid or, you know, 52-year-old man or whatever, that's all in the first chapter, because you start, that's the building block of character is compassion.
Completely.
So you start with that and then you move on to the other things, because hopefully you have that foundation of compassion, and then you can move on to really dealing with the real world that is out there. You do it a lot better if you've got that compassion.
100%. And it is foundational. I truly believe that.
Yeah.
And you've demonstrated that in having it as the first chapter of your book.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I'm still making my way through. I would have had it done by now if my wife and I didn't get hit with bronchitis over the weekend, man.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it was rough. My goodness. But we're out of the woods. We're on the upswing. And so, you know, I picked the book back up. So I want to thank you for sharing that with me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I want to give the listeners an opportunity to get a copy of that book as well. So, Jeff, how can the listeners follow you, connect with you, learn more about the the great publications and other discussions you've had with other publications, as sure. well as get a copy of the book.
The best place, Aubrey, is to get is for folks to go to my website where all my blogs and podcasts and books are. It's called NelliganBooks.com.
Okay.
And then I have an X page at Resilient Sons, an Instagram page, Nelligan_books, and a Facebook page, Jeff Nelligan Books. And all four places, it's just shows the various, you know, timelines of stories about my sons and what they're doing now in terms of their military careers. Two are naval officers. One, as I mentioned, plays pro rugby, but he also will be going back to infantry officer school in fall of this year at Fort Benning. So those are the places where I can be found.
That is wonderful, Jeff. We are going to put each of those social media handles as well as your NelliganBooks.com for the website in the episode show notes so the listeners can follow you on social media, go to your website, look at the different books, check out the blog while listening to this wonderful conversation. I just want to, again, thank you for coming on the show, sharing your insights. I truly appreciate it. The listeners appreciate it. And I hope we can stay in touch and bring you back on the show in the near future.
I'd love that, Aubrey. And thanks for such a great interview and just kind of lead me down the path, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, no, my pleasure. My pleasure. It's so great to have you, man. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in and listening. And hey, look, you may feel like this at times, but in our daily struggles and adversities, hope is always around the corner. And you're never, never alone. And when it really comes down to it, you know, we're just all roadies on this journey of life. But it sure feels good having you on the road with me. Thanks again for listening. We'll chat again soon.
We really hope you enjoyed this episode of The Roads Rediscovery. We'd love to hear from you. Shoot us an email at roadsrediscoverypodcast@gmail.com and leave us any questions or comments you may have.